Hello, I'm on page 146 and we're starting the topic neurobiology and behavior. This is one of the options that are required and we've decided to do option A. On page 146, it starts off with a neurelation in the top left box. It explains what neurelation is. Well, first of all, during embryonic development, the nervous system starts to form, and this formation of the nervous system of the chordate of the spinal cord, this is called neurelation. We humans belong to the phylum Chordata. That means we have a nerve cord, the spinal cord. Of course, not all animals have that. For example, a jellyfish or so, they don't have that. Chordates, they have a nerve cord, and the formation of this nerve cord is called neurelation. How this works is explained in the box below, this is where I'm also going to explain the remaining terms ectoderm, neurotube, and nerve cord, which are also explained in this box. So let's jump ahead into the next box, neurelation in Xenopus, that is an African clawed frog, and that is the model organism that they have used. Okay, and what you see in the drawing, these four drawings here, is a cross section of an embryo. And I'm just going to explain this a little bit here, what the different parts are. It says here the neural plate, this is part of the dorsal surface, and dorsal means back. Okay, so the neural plate can be found on the back of the embryo, and the gut cavity, that is the guts, is another word for digestive system. Okay. And what happens is that the dorsal surface, that is the back part, starts to fold in to form a so-called neural groove. Okay, and something that is not explained here quite well, actually it is explained, but you have to look at the gray scale, at the colors at the bottom. The part that starts to fold in is called the ectoderm, because embryos have an ectoderm, a mesoderm, and an endoderm, and that is something that is also explained with the three gray colors in the box. And the ectoderm, that is the outside layer of cells. The endoderm, that is the inside layer of cells, and this is the one that forms the digestive system. And then you have the mesoderm, which is between them. And what you have is that you have the ectoderm folding in. And basically when it folds in, it starts to make a so-called a neural groove. And this neural groove will then start to form the spinal cord, the nerve cord, and the brain. Okay, then you have a neural tube. So in other words, the nervous system starts to form from the skin, so to say, from the ectoderm of the organism. Okay, and they've used the Xenopus, the African clawed frog, as a so-called model organism to understand the whole thing, because the embryo is transparent. Okay. So that is we've talked basically in this picture. I've now talked about the different terms here as well. So the embryo, the outermost layer, the so-called ectoderm, starts to fold inward to make a neural groove. Okay, to make a so-called neural tube. Okay, and sometimes this process does not work properly in human beings, for example. And when the babies are born, they have a so-called an open back, and this condition, this problem is called spina bifida. And it's like this, that we have the so-called the vertebrae. These are the bones. These vertebrae, they surround the spinal cord, the nerve cord. And sometimes when there is a problem in neurelation, then there is a hole in the back of the baby called spina bifida, and this condition is called spina bifida. And this basically, you can see it in the picture here on page 146, you can see that then the fluid inside the spinal cord starts to go out. Okay, so that's something that has to be treated surgically. Okay, so that is when basically the neural tube does not close up completely during embryonic development. And then you have, of course, this condition called spina bifida, okay? And there is a cross-section, an X-ray of this here, yeah? I just talked about the African clawed frog, and there is the next box using animal models. And the thing is the following. If you want to understand something about human beings, for example, obviously it's not so easy for ethical reasons and for other reasons, not so easy and not so good to do experiments on humans. Obviously, and for this reason, our scientists are using so-called model organisms. And these model organisms are animals that can also be plants, but then of course when we investigate neurobiology, then we are of course interested in animals because they have a nervous system. The idea is that we use them, they have been agreed on, so they are basically they are standardized organisms that scientists have agreed on to use when doing research. Okay, if you want to use a different terminology, you call this control of variables. If you want to investigate something, then you want to make sure that, and if you want to be able to compare your data, then you better make sure that you're working on the same organism. Otherwise, you might not be able to compare the data. And I just want to tell you something over here. What some of these organisms are here at the box. C. elegans. C. elegans. Is actually not a flatworm, it's a roundworm, doesn't matter, it's a little worm. Then you have Drosophila, which is a fruit fly, you've got the zebrafish, you have got the African clawed frog Xenopus, which I talked already about, and you have the house mouse, Mus musculus. What you can do is of course you can investigate these organisms and do experiments concerning brain development, for example, spinal cord development, and whatever. Okay. So that is, I would actually know the examples of some of these model organisms that are used. Then, by the way, they're not only used for neurobiology, they're also used for studying other characteristics, okay? Medication, whatever, medicine, mouse, for example. Yeah. So page 147, the next one. Development of the nervous system. We now basically move on a little bit. So the first page 146 was during embryonic development. Now the organism is now an adult, and however the nervous system continues to develop, of course, okay? And it says the development of neurons. Neurons are nerve cells. And one thing that you have to understand is that in the brain, but not only, but a lot in the brain, nerve cells communicate with each other over so-called synapses. A synapse are small gaps between nerve cells. And by using chemicals, so-called neurotransmitters, one nerve cell communicates with the next one. And there are uncountable, so many synapses in the brain. And it's often like this, that it's not only like this, that one nerve cell has one synapse with another one, but actually there can be hundreds or thousands of different nerve cells. And it's not only a one-to-one connection, one nerve cell with another one, but sometimes there are many, many nerve cells connecting with each other. It's not only a one-to-one thing, okay? Maybe 50, 100 nerve cells connecting with one and one spreading out and connecting with 50 others, you know, and this with a few billion nerve cells, it's a lot of connections here, okay? So what we have is something called a multiple synapses, okay? So these are the connections. It's not only a one-to-one thing, but you have multiple synapses. But when you learn something, then you will start to form new synapses. That's normal, okay? However, sometimes old synapses are not needed anymore, and old nerve cells are not needed anymore, because other nerve cells have taken up their job, and then they have to be removed. Okay, so these nerve cells and these synapses, they are removed. And this process of removing nerve cells is called neural pruning, which is important. Okay, this is an important part. And also in the learning process. So the breaking and forming of new synapses is learning. So that's how the information is stored in your brain, is by having different, synapses. But sometimes, so certain synapses and nerve cells are not needed anymore, and then you do the body does something called neural pruning, they're removed. Okay. Next box, development of the CNS. CNS stands for central nervous system. Okay. There are two parts in the nervous system. It's called the central nervous system, and this makes the brain and the spinal cord. And then you have this called the peripheral nervous system, which are the nerves that are connected to the central nervous system, okay? And as a matter of fact, in the book, in a different page, when they talk about the so-called the reflex arc, you'll have basically the central nervous system and the peripheral nerves explained. So if you want to maybe check the part, I cannot find it right now in the book, the so-called the reflex arc, then this is explained as well. And this is then basically a cross-section of the picture that you have in this box down here as well. Okay, so and what you see over here is you see a cross section of the spinal cord, and you see parts of the central and parts of the peripheral nervous system. You have over here so-called white matter, and this white matter is made of myelinated axons. the axons are the long parts of a nervous system. You might want to check topic 6 about the structure of a nervous system. And the white matter are the axons, the myelin, and the gray matter, these are the nerve cell bodies. Okay, so you see there are a lot of nerve cells here. And then to the spinal cord, you have nerves attached, the so-called the spinal nerves. And you also have, that's part of the peripheral nervous system, the spinal nerves. And then there's also something called the dorsal root ganglion. And the dorsal root ganglion is again made of nerve cell bodies. So in other words, you see a lot of nerve cells in this drawing here, right? Okay, so that is basically the thing that I just do want to explain here in the cross section, okay? It's important to understand that new nerve cells, of course, are produced, and old nerve cells are also broken down. It also mentions this here in the box here, okay? Far more neurons are needed than the initially present in the embryonic neural tube. Yeah, so basically, cell proliferation continues, the cells continue to divide, okay, in both the developing spinal cord and the brain. Yeah, so that is basically the thing. You have, of course, many more nerve cells nowadays than we had when we were embryos, so new nerves had to form, okay? So that is kind of the thing. So what we have is, for your information, is if you go back to 146 to the four drawings here, in the neurulation in Xenopus, you see that the neural tube will ultimately form the picture on page 147 here, the spinal cord. Yeah, so that is basically where we want to go to. Okay, so that's we have a look at the spinal cord now on page 147, the top structure of the brain. We see a cross-section of the brain. Okay, and the different parts. And what I'm going to do now is the following. There's really no point in me just telling you what you see because you see it already. But I, as a matter of fact, I'm combining this right now, the labeling, with the function of the parts. And the function you can find on the next page, on page 148, in function of parts of the brain. In the top right box on page 148, you have the function. And on page 147, you have the structure. Okay, so I'm going to be flipping back and forth here. Okay. Structure of the brain, cerebral hemispheres. Okay, cerebral hemispheres. Okay, and you also see it on in the photograph further down. The left hemisphere and also the right hemisphere is present. They didn't label the right one, obviously. So, and what do the cerebral hemispheres do? The cerebral hemispheres, on page 148, they have many different functions. Oh, really? Of course, yeah. Which I explained on the next page. Wow, great. I will tell you the functions. The cerebral hemispheres are generally important. Page 149 is explained in more detail, but they're generally important for all the conscious activities. Okay? So all the higher mental reasoning, sense perception, okay, vision, speaking, talking, language, personality, all of these conscious activities, the things that make us humans, individuals, okay, this is basically that what takes place in the central hemisphere. And these are further again explained more on page 149. So it says here functions of the cerebral hemispheres, somatosensory cortex, motor cortex, visual cortex, and so on. Okay. But in summary, the cerebral hemispheres are responsible for sense perception, okay, for movement, okay, and for all the conscious thinking activities. Go back here. Hypothalamus. Okay, what does the hypothalamus do? The hypothalamus is basically the link between the brain, the nervous system, and the endocrine system, which is the hormone system. It is linked to the so-called the pituitary gland, which produces hormones. And a few of the hormones that you already know from the reproductive chapter on reproduction is, for example, FSH and LH in the female are produced in the pituitary gland. Okay, so there are some really important. It's called the master gland. It's really the central one, and this is the place. The hypothalamus, which is connected to the pituitary gland, this is the place where you have the nervous system and the endocrine system, the hormone system, interacting with each other. Okay, so that is the hypothalamus has the pituitary connected. Okay, so I'm kind of explained both of them together now. Hypothalamus on page 147 in the middle, and then the small gland, pituitary gland, and then you have the cerebellum. Okay, and the cerebellum coordinates unconscious functions, especially movement and balance. Okay, and there was a question of a student once, well, I thought that actually the ears are responsible for balance. Yeah, of course, they have the receptors, okay? the labyrinth, okay, inside the ear is responsible for balance. But this information has to be interpreted somewhere, okay? And this is done in the cerebellum. The balance and movement is coordinated in the cerebellum. And then we have the medulla oblongata, which is also in pretty much in the middle of the brain, above the spinal cord. And the medulla oblongata is important for automatic activities, like swallowing is an automatic activity, digestion, vomiting, breathing, heart rate. Okay, and these automatic nervous system functions are also explained in the box below. Okay, so what you have over here is a cross-section of the brain, and very briefly, to summarize this, the life-maintaining functions are found in the middle of the brain. Okay, that's where we have the hypothalamus, the pituitary, the medulla oblongata. These are the life-maintaining functions, and all the higher thinking activities and the conscious sense perception, that's taking place in the cerebral hemispheres. So if there's some kind of a damage to the cerebral hemisphere, you might not be able to see, you might not be able to talk properly, you might have other, you might be impaired in other ways, but the life-maintaining functions like breathing and heart rate and so on, they should go on. Okay, when I just said heart rate, you might remember that isn't the heart rate automatic, independent of the brain? It's called myogenic. Well, the actual beating, yes, but the speed of the heart rate can be controlled or is controlled by the brain, okay? But not the actual beating itself, okay? So what I've done right now is kind of linked. I kind of linked the pictures on page 147 with their function. And what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to continue on page 148. The question is now, that's all very nice, but how do we know? I mean, how do I know that which part of the cerebral hemisphere is responsible for what? Okay, and there are three ways how you can figure out. Okay, so first of all, you can look at people that have so-called brain lesions, autopsy, and this means the following: if a person has a brain tumor, for example, in a certain part, you can figure out where is this brain tumor. After the person died, and then you know, okay, the person had problems speaking. So, and where is the brain tumor? It's on this place of the brain. So this place of the brain might be responsible for speaking. Okay, so you kind of try to figure this out. Okay, a person has some kind of a brain bleeding. Okay, then this can also tell you the location where this bleeding is, can tell you what the brain function is. Which function this part of the brain is responsible for, okay? And then autopsy, what you do is you basically look at the dead person and you cut open the brain and you check which part is damaged. And then you know which brain part was responsible for what, depending on what the person was not able to do. Animal experiments, the second one, we already talked about the so-called model organisms. And in the case of animal experiments, it's like this, that you have a mouse and you try to, using a surgery, you kind of destroy part of the mouse's brain, and then you observe what the mouse is not able to do anymore. Okay, and then you can figure out what brain part was responsible to do what. Not very nice, but we try to figure this out anyway because we need to know. Yeah, so ethical debates, of course, I leave this up to you. And the next one is functional MRI. And these are basically brain scans, and they have a significant advantage. First of all, advantage number one is it's non-invasive. This means you don't have to do any surgery, you don't have to do anything, okay? You can do it on healthy people, and you can do experiments on healthy people. And what does fMRI do? It basically monitors which part of the brain are more active than others, depending on the blood flow. Because those parts of the brain that are more active, they need more oxygen, and therefore there's a higher blood supply. And this fMRI, this basically can detect how much blood flow there is, okay? So if you if they tell you, close your eyes and imagine a sunset, okay? And then you imagine a sunset, and then they're going to check which part of the brain is now active. And not surprisingly, it should be the visual center of the brain which is active, because you're imagining it, imagining a picture. Okay, or if they ask you, okay, do a certain math calculation, and other parts of the brain are again active. Yeah? Or if you listen to music, for example, and again other parts are active. Okay, so that's basically something that they can do. And the good thing again is it's non-invasive. You don't have to operate, you can communicate with a patient, or not patient, with a subject. Yeah? Yeah, so that's you get a high resolution scan, okay? And that is something that you can then use for research, okay? So, I already talked about the function of the parts of the brain. I'm now going to continue with the so-called autonomic nervous system. The autonomic nervous system is the nervous system which is not under your control. Okay, so all the life-maintaining functions are control of the organs and so on. All these things are done over the autonomic nervous system, and they connect to the so-called medulla oblongata, which you already also know. Okay. So that means three examples are swallowing. Okay, so that is, you can say, well, that's not correct. I can swallow whenever I want. Yeah, but when you eat food, for example, you don't have to consciously think about swallowing. You just swallow the food, right? You don't have to say, okay, I have to chew now and now I have to swallow because I need to swallow, right? No, you just swallow. It goes automatic. Yeah. Breathing is another one. For example, when you don't have enough oxygen, you start to breathe faster. Okay, you know, when you're running, you have to breathe faster. Right? Because you need more oxygen. But you're not saying, well, I have to breathe faster now. No, you're just breathing faster. Okay? Because they detect the amount of CO2 in your receptors, detect the amount of CO2 in your blood. Okay? These are so-called chemoreceptors. They detect CO2. And because if there's a lot of CO2 in your blood, then the pH is lower. Okay? So these receptors, they check the pH of your blood, and if your pH is too low, then this means there's too much CO2 in your blood, and this basically then tells nerves, then tell your lungs to contract faster and more. Okay? And we have the heart rate. Okay? And there are three terms in here. Okay? The autonomic nervous system is again subdivided into two parts, the so-called sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, and the thing is the following: they are antagonists. They mean they work against each other. And what the sympathetic one does is the following: they cause the heart rate to speed up. Okay, and the parasympathetic one, they cause the heart rate to slow down. So when you're excited and active, okay, then the sympathetic nervous system is active. Okay, there's a way how you can remember this. If you see a person that you have not seen for a long time that you like, the person is sympathetic to you, you're getting all excited. How is that? Okay? So sympathetic means getting excited. And the parasympathetic one means it calms you down. Okay? So during the day when you're active and awake, and then the sympathetic one is more active. And during night when you sleep, the parasympathetic one is more active. Okay? So they kind of work against each other. Okay? So, that was basically the autonomic nervous system, and the autonomic nervous system is basically part of the peripheral nervous system. Okay. Stroke. What is a stroke? A stroke is when there is part of the blood supply to a part of the brain is cut short because of a blockage of a blood vessel. And as a consequence, what happens is that part of this brain does not get enough oxygen. Okay, so actually that's a brain lesion. It's one of these brain problems that I just talked about. It doesn't get enough oxygen. This brain, part of the brain, can die off. Then you have an irreversible damage. This means that the person is not able to do certain things. Okay. By doing brain scans, you can figure out where the stroke was. Okay. So that is, it basically depends where in the brain the stroke took place. That kind of depends a little bit or determines a little bit on what the person is still able to do and not able to do. Okay, so if a stroke is somewhere in the language center of the brain, for example, the person might have a problem speaking. Okay, and then the person must find alternative ways to deal with that, and other brain parts can take over a little bit the functions of the damaged brain parts. But a stroke is a blocking of the blood supply of some brain regions. Okay, so that is the thing. Okay, so page 149. I'll just, after page 149, I'm going to stop this audio here, and then I'm going to continue a different one. Cerebral hemispheres. Now, we talk about in more detail about the cerebral hemispheres. The top box says evolution of the cerebral cortex, okay? The cerebral cortex, that is the outermost part of the cerebral hemisphere, okay? So the brain has the cerebral hemisphere, obviously, and the cerebral hemisphere has an outermost layer, and this is called the cerebral cortex. And it's only a few millimeters thick, but there are a lot of neurons there, okay? And these neurons are all highly networked over synapses. And we humans have a more developed cerebral cortex than other organisms or other mammals. And what happened over the evolution of the human being is that this cerebral cortex has become much larger, so it's physically much larger, and there is also a larger surface area, because if you look on the picture on page 147, you can see that the brain has many infoldings. Okay, so that is a large surface area. So the cerebral cortex has a large surface area to allow for more neurons to interconnect with each other. Okay. So that is, it contains these foldings, okay, and otherwise you would not have enough space for the cerebral cortex, okay. That's basically it. So the cerebral cortex in humans is quite large, and its increased surface area is yet increased. So, and now, I'm going back to the thing that I actually should have talked before, the function of the cerebral hemispheres, okay, so what do they do? And they are... as I mentioned, they're responsible for learning, memory, emotions, sense perception, all these things. And the somatosensory cortex, that's the part of the brain that receives the sensory inputs, okay? And what happens is that there is, if a person has, is all of a sudden paralyzed on the left side of the body, is not able to move the left arm, leg, and then usually it means that there is a lesion, maybe a stroke on the right side of the brain. So it's the right part of the hemisphere of the brain controls the left side of the body and vice versa, because the nerves cross over. Okay, the motor cortex is responsible for controlling the voluntary muscles. So those muscles that connect to the bones. Okay, the so-called the skeletal muscles. Okay. Again, we have over here a crossing over. It controls the muscles on the right side of the body and the left side of the brain, okay? And vice versa. Then you have in the back of the brain, you have the visual cortex. It's kind of important. If they show you some kind of a scan and the back part of the scan lights up, then you know it must be the visual cortex, because the visual cortex can be found in the back of the brain. And this is where the sensory information from the eyes is processed, okay? So the eyes send their signal to the visual cortex, okay? So that is also important, because the brain must combine the sensory signal of both eyes, and this is done there as well. Okay. Also, for example, the mixing of color, different shades of color, that's all interpreted by the brain in the sensory cortex. The next one is Broca's area, and that is part of the left cerebral hemisphere, and it is the speech center. Okay. So if there's a problem over there, then the person might have problems talking. Okay. In other words, if you are reading a word, or if you're seeing an object and you're naming the object, then this center kind of allows you to combine the picture that you see with the name of the object, okay? And people who have a damage there, a lesion there, they might recognize the object, but they're not able to find the name for it, okay? Because the place where this name is stored is damaged, okay? And the nucleus accumbens in the cerebral hemispheres. That is the so-called the reward center, okay? And basically what happens is that this reward center is activated every time when a person does something enjoyable and pleasurable, okay? And this releases certain neurotransmitters, and dopamine, for example, and this makes the person feel good. For example, after having eaten a good meal, people feel satisfied, and this is because dopamine is secreted in the nucleus accumbens. And certain substances, chemical substances like cocaine, heroin, and so on, they are able to stimulate this reward center without actually there being a reason to be stimulated. So that is the issue a little bit here, that you can also stimulate this using psychoactive drugs, and that's of course a problem, because people can become addicted to it. Now, concerning addiction, people can, I've read somewhere, it's quite interesting, Facebook addiction and things like this. It does exist. And it's like this, that people have to check Facebook all the time, because every time when they get a new status update from a person that they've, from another friend, okay, then there is a little bit of dopamine secreted by the reward center, okay, by the nucleus accumbens. And so basically those folks become addicted to their own dopamine. And that's why they always want to give themselves out. That's why they keep on checking, because they always want to have this little kick. Somebody was looking at my post, or thinking of me, or liking my post, or whatever. Yeah. So it's kind of interesting that people can actually become addicted because of that. So next one, page 149, top sensory and motor homunculi. These are these figures that you see, they look kind of weird, but there is some kind of scientific background to them, obviously. And it's like this. You see that they have gigantic hands, and this means that there are more nerve cells in the cortex receiving information from the hands than from, for example, from the legs. Okay, so the body organs, the proportion, also the lips, for example, they are very large because there are many nerve cell endings there that are processed. Okay, or also, yeah. So that means, and the legs are kind of small because there are not so many nerve cells from there going to the brain. So kind of the size of the body parts kind of represents the importance or the number of nerve cells that are they have in the brain. Okay, and so you can see that the human hand has a very huge number of nerve cells, okay, in the brain that are dealing with controlling the human hand and also picking up stimuli from the fingers and from the hand. Okay, that is kind of the an interesting way to represent and also to show that not all parts of the human body are given equal, how shall I say, importance in the brain. Yeah? Hands are giving a very large importance, lips are giving a large importance, but not so much, for example, the legs and the feet. Okay, so that's kind of the point here. Brain and body size, page 149, bottom box. What you see is the following. Let's compare the body mass to the brain mass. And what you can see is you can see that generally, the larger the body mass, the larger also the brain mass. Okay, and you see that if you put both of them on a logarithmic scale, then you can see actually that it's a line. So it's And the other thing, logarithmic scale, for the reason that otherwise it's too difficult to compress the amount of data in a small space. And what you see is that the primates are generally above the line. These are the black dots, okay? So this means that the primates have, compared to their body mass, a larger brain than other mammals. Okay, so that is, for example, monkeys, apes, humans, they all belong to the primates. And they generally, in many cases, have a larger brain mass. They just say body mass, a larger brain mass than their body mass. Okay, so there is quite a strong positive correlation here. Okay, but we humans, so what we do is we don't have the largest brain over here. Okay, that's important. But compared to the body mass we have, we're pretty much above the line, okay? That's always important to understand. There are other animals around that have a very, very heavy brain, okay? But their body is yet heavier, okay? So that is the thing. But if you look, humans are quite above the line here. So compared to our body mass we have, our brain is pretty, pretty huge, okay? Okay, then, so that is basically the thing that they try to explain over here. So this was basically, the first part of neurobiology and behavior, option A. I wish you a nice day.